history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories while we still can, so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do all that, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every story is a little bit different. Some feature intense combat situations and the closest of calls. Others help us get a more complete picture of life before, during, and after World War II. Today, we're going to hear from one of the 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry who served in our armed forces in World War II. Henry Mizuki is 101 years old now. He was 23 when he tried to join the Army the first time. More on that in a bit. We're also going to hear about an alligator, the Pope, and the bombing of Hiroshima. But he has some pretty compelling memories about life before the war, too. Henry spent much of his life in St. Louis, Missouri. He lives in Michigan now, but he grew up in Central California, the son of immigrants from Japan.
My dad is a fifth of five boys in Hiroshima, big city, Japan. There's a smaller village, but I don't know what it is. In old Japan, if you're the number five child, you don't have any assets. Everything goes to the elder child. So he and his, well, the fourth brother, and he came to Hawaii 1915 or 14 or something like that. And then they didn't like Hawaii, so they came to Los Angeles. The younger of the two brothers didn't like Los Angeles, so he went back to Hawaii, and Dad kind of floated around in Los Angeles area doing a lot of things. I think he even mentioned that he worked as a clerk in the Japanese store. And one of the things that he remembers was the owner of the shop casually dropped a $5 bill, which was, I guess, a lot of money in those days. He actually dropped it, and he watched my father pick it up and return it to him. And he said, "Well, I see I can trust you with the store." But I don't know how long he lived there, but he went to a place called Camarillo, and he did some work. And then from there, I guess he floated up into Central California. He went to work for the Nygren Fund, N-Y-G-R-E-N. I guess it was an arranged marriage, because my mother, she came over to San Francisco. At one time, there used to be a picture of her with about maybe 15 other prearranged marriages of women, young women.
So you're saying they all came over on the same boat to meet their husbands?
And there's a picture of, I think about 15 of them. There used to be an old picture of Dad in his suit and Mom in her Japanese dress. I guess she wore it for the wedding. Later on, there's a picture of her wearing a black coat with an American hat. I think that hat and coat is in one of the trunks in the Sanger home, kind of survived the ransacking that happened during the war. But anyway, I was born in a room under the tank house on the Sanger ranch. Well, I was born in 1919, so it was a little bit after the war had ended, or a couple of months afterwards. Dad wanted to go to enlist in the Army because as Japanese, he did not have citizenship rights. But even though he was Asian, if he had joined the military service, he would have gotten citizenship. As it is, he had to wait about 40 more years until after World War II, when eventually they allowed people from Asia, Chinese and Japanese and I guess Filipinos and things like that, people acquire citizenship in the U.S. I don't remember much about living in the Nygren Ranch. But I do remember a few years later, Dad went to work in Orange Cove, California. They had a large farm. The house that we lived in, And the owner's house, and the owner and two brothers lived further down the street. But I guess the farm was actually big enough that they had grapes on one side and oranges, figs on the other side. The only thing that I can remember about that Orange Cove residence is that one day it rained like heck, and I took out a wash pan. I mean, in those days, there was a kind of a portalized wash pan. My dad was catching rainwater to add to the battery, and I saw it was half full. So instead, I turned the faucet on and filled it up for him. And he said, "Who did that?" And I said, "I did." He said, "You're not supposed to do anything like that." You know, he threw it away because it was tap water more than rainwater. And that's the only thing that I remember. My sister was born about a year and a half after I was born. Dad sent Mom over to a Japanese maternity hospital, I guess, in Fresno. I remember going there, and on the way back, I remember coming back. We came through this kind of a dewy meadow. The moon was shining. He said, "That's my daughter's name. It's Tsukino's Moonlit Meadow. She's gone now. She's been gone 20 years. But that's the second thing that I remember about living in Orange Cove. We went to Sanger, and my dad at that time worked for a big farming conglomerate, what we call a conglomerate now, I guess. The main owner was Leroy Drode. He had a 360-acre farm north of Ventura Avenue and Academy. He also had farms in Delano and up in Madera area. He was involved in shipping figs to New York or out of state. Dad's main responsibility was handling maybe 25 or 30 Japanese single workmen who used to live on the Sanger Ranch. He also had Mexican people who lived in Sanger and who would commute, but they also had a couple of horses and about maybe 10 or 12 mules that did most of the work, I mean, the pulling and the thing. We also had a John Deere tractor, and I can still remember it was a single longer. And you go boom, 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 you know. I don't see them around anymore. Everything is so modernized. But anyway, we grew up there. I guess my young sister that you met earlier came from there. My brother was born there. We lived in a house on that farm. Mr. George often went to New York and also took his son. And his son eventually married a New York showgirl. I went to the Granville School, which is about Indianola and Ventura at that time. Went there until the seventh grade. And then Dad moved to Dinuba on a farm. We lived there a couple of years. I went to a city school. I used to walk about a mile and a half to the city school. Then we came back to Sanger, back to the same ranch. That's where I graduated high school. After I graduated in 36, I went to college, Fresno State. We can stop here now and then we'll continue. Because you may want to ask some questions.
Yeah, I've got some questions. Am I guessing right that Japanese was spoken in your home, but you had to speak English at school?
It was broken English. It was mixed with Japanese and English. All of us, I mean, the kids always spoke English, but then if we communicated to our parents, we always, I guess it was in Japanese, but then we would also throw in English words in there because they understood, not thoroughly. My mother wasn't very fluent with English, but my dad was adequately. I mean, he was enough to communicate with the bosses.
At school, were there other Japanese-American kids in your school? Was it mostly white? Did you feel like you were treated any differently because you were Japanese-American?
Oh, no. I think there were only about 7 families who attended Granville School. In high school, there were more. It was a much more larger community. There were buses that covered quite a bit of area, Sanger. But in the Granville Grammar School, most of the people were Germans of Russian background, a lot of Italians, and some American Caucasian families, and a few Armenians. I don't remember any hostility or any antagonism or anything. You know, we just grew up as kind of a mixed community.
You know, the other thing that I wonder is, you know, these are the years of the Great Depression, where people all over the country are dealing with difficult economic times. Is that something that you saw or felt or understood as a boy or no?
I was too dumb to worry about things like that. I'm sure my parents did because they lost his job. I think the Jones family or the enterprise that he started with, Dad would go down to Los Angeles to market figs and peaches and grapes, which we grew on 360 acres in Sanger. Life was kind of nice at that time. My dad drove around in a Graham Page touring car, which to me at this time seemed like it was 15 or 20 feet long. But it was a canvas top thing, yeah. Trunk in the back, 2 spare tires in the front. We had a expandable gator, whatever you call it, on the running board where we could put things in there. But then when he got released from the farm, we went back to a 1927 Chevrolet, which was a little tiny boxy thing. And so there was a difference. We also had to move from the farm. Dad found a 10-acre farm with a little shack on it. We moved into that little shack for about 4 years until the war started. And then after the war, I came back and I said, Dad, we got to do something. There was one Greek family in particular who had a tremendous amount of acreage out in the west side. And I drive that rickety old truck all the way over to the farm and start up his D4, and it was wheat land, but it was just disking the thing. And I can remember my eye doctor telling me, he said, Henry, you ought to wear glasses. But I didn't. All of this dust and everything used to come in my face, and I'd scratch. And even to this day, my eyes are bloodshot because of all the sand that I got in there. But no, I saved all this money, and I had about $3,300, I think. And we built a little addition to the shack, and that was our home.
And before we go too much further, I'm curious what your ambitions were. Did you have some hopes and dreams as a boy about what you may end up doing in the future?
Yes, well, the funny part was, for some reason, I wanted to be a naval architect, but I could never assume that because the Roth School of Naval Architecture was in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia was, another world. But I can remember my dad saying, well, you don't know anything about naval architecture. And I said, well, I'll show you. So I got some old lumber on the farm. I made a V-shaped form, not a U-shape, but a V-shaped form. And I kind of joined it together with the lath. In those days, the walls were covered with horsehair and mud and sealant. You know, you don't know. You're living under drywall walls. But in those days, it was plastered walls. But in order to plaster, you had laths, little strips, maybe about an inch and a half, quarter of an inch thick, 3 feet long. And they would nail those up on the studs and then slap plaster on the lath. That was our drywall in those days. We had plenty of lath. And so I made this canoe, a V-shaped canoe, and I got canvas. And the only waterproofing that I could was tar. And so my brother and I covered the whole canvas with tar, and then we took it over to the irrigation canal, and of course we put it in there. The moment we got in, because of the configuration of the thing, instead of being a nice rounded flat bottom canoe, it's V-shaped, and it tipped over, and of course we were And when, not only that, but we were covered with tar. And I can remember my mom getting really provoked because she didn't know how to clean all this tar off of us. And one of the trips that Dad went down to Los Angeles was he brought back an alligator. And in the middle of our house, Mom, being a freshly, well, she was an immigrant of only 4 or 5 years. She built a chrysanthemum garden right next to the house. But when Dad brought back the alligator, we dug out a little pond and filled it up with concrete. And that's where our little alligator lived until, well, it gradually grew bigger. Probably outgrew the pond. I can't remember that. But one day it was gone, and we tracked in the dirt. We could see the 4 feet moving and the tail dragging, and it went to this canal, the Hanson Canal, ran alongside of Ventura Avenue. Well, it went into the canal and said, oh, I guess it's seeking its natural resources. 3 or 4, maybe 6 months later, a guy in Kingsburg says, hey, we found a alligator. They had captured it. It's the alligator that you see in the Fresno Zoo now. It's still living. It was a couple of years ago when we came. So if it's there, if you see an alligator, we think, we don't know for sure, but it's the only alligator that's been found in Central California back in about, I was maybe 10, so that would be 1929. I don't know whether it's still there or not, but if it is, I claim that it's my alligator.
And I guess the best way for anybody listening to find out for sure is to pay a visit to the Fresno Chaffee Zoo in Fresno, California. You never know what kind of stories you might hear on Hometown Heroes, and there are plenty more to come from 101-year-old Henry Mizuki. But it's time for our first break. When we come back, how Henry experienced December 7th, 1941, and the traumatic events that followed when more than 100,000 Japanese Americans in the western U.S. were forced from their homes and stripped of their freedom, even those who were citizens by virtue of having been born here. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.